If you're looking for the perfect gift, you're covered with a gift that's sure to wow. Taste of Chicago ships Lou Malnati's legendary deep dish pizzas nationwide. Plus, they ship other Windy City favorites too. Visit tastesofchicago.com to order today.
You know, it's Christmas. It's Christmas time. The time for prayer. The time to visit friends. And here's the ideal Christmas visit I'd have with you. Here's how it goes. First thing, I'd get up early, drive over to a great bakery and find an excellent coffee cake. I don't know what they do in other places, but Chicagoans are taught by our parents never to go empty-handed to someone's house. And so I'll bring a coffee cake, like a cake from Calumet Bakery or Pichek and Son on 55th and Narragansett, or maybe Weber's Bakery on Archer Avenue. Okay, you pick up a nice coffee cake, but no poppy seed, okay? Why not? Because this is not your idealized Christmas dream. It's my idealized Christmas visit. And I don't like poppy seed coffee cake, but blueberry? Yeah. Apple? Yeah. Walnut? Yes, of course. I knock on the door, take a step back, as I learned from the precinct captains, off the stoop, and let you open the door and welcome me in. And then you can make a pot of coffee. We'll have coffee in your kitchen, in one of the many tasteful coffee mugs to be found. Where else? John Cass News. Under shop. Like the Chicago Way mug with Jeff Carlin and me. Or the No Chumbalone Zone mug, because we don't like being chumbalones. Yeah, Christmas is the time of thankful prayer, because God sent his only son to redeem us of our sins. And yeah, it's the time for Christmas hunts with a good dog on hard fields. And those of you who can still walk, please go walking with those you love. You'll never know how much you miss it when you can't. It's a time for a great Christmas ride on a good horse in the snow, if we have snow. And we gather together, like friends, gather in your kitchen, around the kitchen table. I can see Jeff Carlin. Yeah, Jeff, my good friend and co-host who's sitting there at your kitchen table, the WGN executive producer. He's also co-host of the Chicago Way. Jeff Carlin is an excellent baker, professional grade. He's always there. And also here with us today on the Chicago Way podcast is Jude Russo, editor of the American Conservative, one of my favorite publications. I even list it under recommended reading on the right side at John Cass News. And I didn't tell him this, but if he wants to use one of my pieces, he would do me a great honor. And me? Yeah, I'm the guy who loves coffee cakes, even though I'm not supposed to have any. And coffee. And time to visit with you in your kitchen, as we're visiting right now. I'm John Cass, editor of JohnCassNews.com. That's right, JohnCassNews.com, where you always get a good cup of common sense. And where are you as everyone's bustling around, either pre or post Christmas, with prayers and happiness in their eyes when they see their friends and are invited inside to have a nice cup of coffee? You're on the Chicago Way podcast, the Christmas edition on WGN Plus.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago Way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
The Chicago Way.
That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
You know, I always say as promised, but if you read the if you read my website, John Cass News, you'll see on the right railing a list of my favorite publications. And I will tell you truthfully that Jacobin is not one of my favorites. But you know what is? The American Conservative. And the editor of the American Conservative, Jude Rousseau, is here to speak with us about the future of the conservative movement and the future of conservative media. Joining us today is, of course, the aforementioned Jude Rousseau, and also Jeff Carlin, co-host here, my buddy, friend, and master of pies and baker of pies and friend of cats. And me, I'm John Cass of johncassnews.com, where you always get a good cup of Midwestern common sense. And Jeff and Jude, what is the future of the conservative movement now with Trump so large and looming all over all of it?
Well, I'm happy to take a swing
yes, please.
At that first. But first, just wanted to say thank you for having me on. Always a pleasure to talk to people who are thoughtful, who've been in the game for a while. So I'm really glad to be here. I think that the future of the conservative movement is going to be sort of delineated by two main dynamics. The first is that Trump is looming large right now following his electoral victory, and especially his popular vote victory. But I think that balancing that to a degree is the fact that he will not be running in 2028. The fact that he's term limited at this point means that extending his legacy and solidifying his legacy after this term is going to be in somebody else's hands. It's not a certain future the same way it would be if he were serving consecutive terms. So it's clear that he has certain instincts that where he's trying to drive the movement, drive the party. He yesterday announced his support for the Longshoremen's Union in their negotiations with the U.S. Maritime Alliance, which honestly surprised me a little bit. So it's clear that he is serious, at least at the outset here, about building his and maintaining his working class coalition. But if he's going to move forward with that, if that's going to be the future of conservatism and the future of the GOP, I think that it depends on whether we're going to have a recession in the next 4 years, because whoever runs after him is going to have to either provide an alternative, you know, here's where we went wrong and that's why we're suffering this recession, or is going to be able to sort of justify the incumbent's record without being the incumbent. So that's sort of where my head's at right now. Jeff, what do you think?
Yeah, Jude. Well, absolutely. Thanks for joining us. And it's interesting, right? I mean, you know, his big thing was winning re-election. I mean, that's what everyone was looking at. And the kind of the after was, you know, there's all this rumblings about the, you know, Project 2025 or whatever, and this, that. And it really is like, as we've talked to people like Charles Lipson, and it's time for the rubber to hit the road, and let's see what's going to happen. And I think you've got this legacy, right? I mean, the Trump family does have some people. There's a large Trump out there who there are rumblings that may be a pick for Senate in Florida to replace some of the appointees if they make it through. You know, there's at least a thought there. What does that mean? Is it Trump's legacy going to be dismantling the bureaucracy as his family and, you know, everybody in his circle sees it. And is that the conservative movement? Like that says it's, you know, a smaller government through this plus, you know, business. And we've heard Trump say that, you know, trying to bring down food prices is already going to be hard, right? That's a thing that, you know, he's talked about. He's looking forward to working on, but the guy who doesn't usually admit anything, chink in the armor kind of thing, is like, yeah, it's going to be a tough thing. We'll see what happens. You know, that type of mentality, you know, is aligning himself with the longshoremen. At least he's certainly trying to make it himself bulletproof in a sense, because he has this thing on his shoulders because he was popularly elected and he's got a legacy to build on. I don't know. I think it's hopefully that's what it is, right? It's not this, in my opinion, it's not this, you know, take down those who came before me and, you know, burn the bridges, burn the villages, that kind of mentality. And I hope that goes both ways. Like, you know, that people aren't standing in his way, because, you know, like you said, you can't, recession kills us all, right? It brings us all down. It just makes everything worse. But I don't know. What do you think, on a big picture, where does the next line in Trump's orbit lead? I mean, we do have Kushner still out there as our names. We've got other Trumps in the mix. Who do you think picks up the reins?
I think that Vance is in the catbird seat, if assuming that all goes well. If things go poorly, I think that he is rightly or wrongly sort of associated with the characteristic Trump pivots, especially on economic issues. Mm-hmm. So if it goes badly, I think he has a harder row to hoe come 2028. But I think that Vance is well positioned. I think that the bench in the Senate's pretty deep. I think that Ted Cruz has another run in him. He's very successfully rebranded himself since 2016. As sort of a, you know, he's still a classic Reagan Republican, but he's changed his image to be a little bit more Trumpy. I think that Tom Cotton has a pretty bright future. I think that there is still a significant hawkish wing in the Republican Party that likes a lot of the rhetoric of America First, but is not necessarily persuaded on the retrenchment aspect of the Trump platform. I think that Cotton is sort of a natural standard bearer for that. Once upon a time, Mike Pompeo, I think, was sort of the standard bearer for that. But he, I think...
Shot himself in the foot, right?
Beg your pardon?
He shot himself in the foot, didn't he?
I think that that's so. I think that the business stuff that he had going on in Ukraine looks hinky, even if it wasn't. I think that positioning himself for a run against Trump and then not going through with it puts him in an odd position. He's not going to be in this administration. So while I think that Mr. Pompeo has a lot to recommend him, especially as an administrator, I think that he's just sort of out of the game for the foreseeable future.
One of the things that surprises me, I guess I shouldn't be surprised because I'm so old now that I've seen everything, is the personality cult around Trump, which I don't know if it really is conservative in the classic sense. When I began reading the American conservative magazine, Buchanan and Taiki Theotokopoulos were the resident wits there. And the idea was that being a conservative was a sensibility. It wasn't really like you couldn't brand yourself as a party man as a conservative. It was more a general temperament. And I wondered from you guys if the American Conservative magazine has that changed? And what is being a conservative now mean anyway?
Well, that's the money question. I will say among our stable of writers and editors, there is a diversity of opinions. Our editor emeritus, Bob Mary, still feels that the personal factors for Trump are disqualifying. You know, he has a bad character. He should not be in charge of the country.
Sure.
A number of our foreign policy writers don't really like this or that thing he did in the first term. On the other hand, he has been the vehicle for a lot of those Buchananite policies. So I think that part of what you're seeing with the Trump cult of personality is there is sort of unconservative aspect to it. There's it's not necessarily principled. But I think that since that tends to be the loudest segment of his coalition, its size and influence is a little overstated. I think that a lot of the people, especially when you sort of look at the demographics of Trump voters in 2016, you're seeing a lot of the same people who were involved with the Tea Party at the grassroots, and who were involved with Ted Tancredo or Fred Thompson's insurgency candidacies, people who, have held for a long time and relatively thoughtfully these conservative positions and have just not been able to find the personal vehicle for it. And so I think that that's sort of the difficulty of Trump for, somebody who's been bouncing around in conservatism for a while. It looks as if his force of personality is what pushed this suite of policies to electoral victory.
Sure.
It is an overwhelming personality, but I do give it cre him credit because if he had not, he did have the forceful personality to take the bushes by the roots and pull them and the entire neocon, endless war nonsense of the never Trumpers and pull them out of the party. And if he hadn't done that back then, I don't see the Republicans winning the House and the Senate now, and the as they did, and the White House. But he did do that, so I guess I want to give him a hat tip there. I think that we sell him too short sometimes, because especially in conservative circles, I think he's not. I mean, I know that the call now, that call is out. The senator from Indiana is sort of hesitant to support Pete Hegseth. And there are many conservatives out there in the, internet and so forth demanding his head. I forgot even what his name is. You have it? I don't know. They
Oh.
want him finished. And I don't think that's a conservative viewpoint, really. Like, you didn't vote for my guy, so we're gonna cancel you. But I don't think that's really a conservative virtue.
At the same time, I think that a certain amount of what looks like, pettiness and personal grievance mongering on Trump's part, I think that that is partly how the Bushes, how he expelled the Bushes from the party and purged the party of their influence. I think that after his first term, especially, he felt that the party was not all on board with his program, and he went about removing the people he saw as obstructions. And while the style maybe leaves something to be desired, I think that especially when you're dealing with some of the foreign policy inertia, because foreign policy makers tend to turn over very slowly. I think that that sort of hard driving aspect of his personality was an asset and maybe inextricable from whatever success he's had in remaking the party. So, like I said, it leaves something to be desired on a style, on the style side, but I do wonder whether somebody who is, you know, a little bit better polished and a little bit less vindictive would have been able to, you know.
I don't see that. I don't only see
there's
that
no one there.
Candidate
yeah.
in fantasy, but in the real world, Trump filled the bill. I give the man incredible and immense amounts of credit for that, to get rid of the Bushes.
And he's certainly forced into that position too. I mean, Judy, your point that, you know, his style is certainly what probably carried him the carried the day for him, but and brought out people who, you know, saw that what the other side is putting up as being this soft, mealy, you know, wish-washy thing, or this thing pushing something they weren't comfortable with, or whatever the reasoning for, you know, supporting Trump. His ability to be that pugilist, it appealed to a lot of people. And like you said, it's definitely got him there, but it's not necessarily going to make it an easy road to head. I mean, that's the cover of your guys' latest edition is, you know, a great, you know, majority if you can keep it, right? And what is that future road? I mean, what is the trouble you think he's going to face?
Well, I think that handing the baton without that force of personality is a little bit hard. I think that one question is this coalition durable, or is it particular to Trump? I already mentioned that, you know, we are due for an economic correction. I think it's hard if there's a recession. I think that there are just inherent challenges with the coalition that he's built. You know, he, like I said yesterday, he came out in favor of the longshoremen who are threatening to go on strike in the middle of January in the East Coast ports if the U.S. Maritime Alliance doesn't change their automation plans for the East Coast ports. And, you know, this makes his newfound buddies in the unions very happy. This makes the sort of more economically, the sort of working man aspect of his coalition happy. But then it makes the Silicon Valley guys who came out for him pretty unhappy. They're all pushing innovation. They rightly note that American ports are hugely inefficient. And they think that this is a sort of silly hill to plant a flag on. So I think that there are inherent tensions in this broader coalition that he's built that are going to have to be resolved somehow, or balanced somehow. And he's done a pretty good job of balancing it so far, but, you know, we're at, you know, day zero. So I think that those are a few things. I do think that on the world stage, there are tremendous pressures on the United States to get involved in several theaters. I can think of at least three.
At least.
And I think that if he gets involved in a war, gets involved in a war that does not arise from an attack on American soil, I guess I should emphasize. I think
what do you think of Syria? What about Syria? He's been asked to get involved in Syria. He has put out like X posts or Twitter tweets, whatever.
Sure.
No interest in.
Well, that was a kind of a hallmark of his first term. I mean, he wore that as a badge of honor, that he was pulling the U.S. troops out of everywhere as fast as he could and said, we're not, nobody, no active new engagements under my watch. I mean,
well, part of it is in Obama, you know, Obama is the one who drew the line in the sand in Syria and made a fool out of himself with Putin and Assad. And now I don't know what is going to happen with it. I do know that whoever screwed it up will not get the blame, because that's how Washington does not allow that to happen. It doesn't stick to you, you know, if you can help it.
That is very true. And I mean, that's arguably the besetting problem of American foreign policy. I mean, people, because it happened during COVID and the election. There's so much happening in 2020. People forget the general, he told the generals to get out of Syria, and they just pretty much refused. They slow walked it until Trump gave up on trying to get American troops out of Syria. I think that Trump's attitude is right on Syria. These are not pleasant people on any side. One Mr. Nicholas Cass has written for the American Conservative.
Yeah, I know him.
I've heard of him.
With if I dare say, tremendous insight, prescience, and some good editing too. about the sort of side that the United States has been funding and supplying, and they're pretty nasty characters. There's not much more to say, I think, about the al-Nusra Front, which is sort of the dominant anti-Assad force in Syria currently. It's a bunch of not very rehabilitated al-Qaeda guys. So I think that Trump has the mandate not to get involved. It's not like, you know, September 12th, 2001, where we had to go into Afghanistan. There was no way we were just going to sit here politically. The country wanted something done. I don't think that there's any mandate to get involved in Syria. I think that the American people right now are very tired of Middle Eastern wars. I think that he is much less inclined to be buffaloed by generals this time. I think that when you look at his cabinet appointments, you see that. You know, Hegseth, there's this conversation, does he have the experience to run the Department of Defense? And that's a relevant question. It's a huge department. But I think that on the other side of it, that the mainstream press especially refuses to see, is that Hegseth is not a guy who's been captured in the revolving door of general to Raytheon, Raytheon to general.
Right. Yeah, right. What, speaking of that, I mean, what do you think of the rest of his cabinet here? I mean, he's got some interesting picks. I mean, there's certainly people who are loyal to him, and that seems to be a very, I mean, not surprisingly, but it seems to be a very strong indicator of where people are landing and in what roles. Well, I mean, anybody else stand out to you as good or bad?
I like Tulsi. I think that she is more likely than anyone else to do what needs to be done with the security state, which is declassify anything that you can get your hands on. We need a full illustration of what the American security state has been doing, especially since the war on terror, when things sort of kicked into overdrive, but really since the 70s. I think that
What about that Illinois senator who keeps smearing Tulsi Gabbard without giving any evidence? What's her name again? Tammy Duckworth? She's more unctuous and oily than Dick Durbin, and I thought that'd be impossible, but she fills the bill now. She's like the oily, bottom-feeding fish with the glistening skin that you can't hold. And she's trashing Tulsi as an agent of what? Syrian agent that we're going to put in charge of our national intelligence? Is that the rap? Is that the thing that she's putting down?
It seems that they can't decide whether she's a Putin agent or an Assad agent. If she's an Assad agent, that seems like a non-issue as of last week. It's this classic smear you see against anyone who says, well, maybe we should not get involved with whatever set of nasty characters, as being the same as endorsing a given set of nasty characters. So Duckworth is an interesting character. She's a veteran. If memory serves, she lost the use of her legs.
Lost them entirely.
Handpicked by Rahm Emanuel.
That's right. So she, I think, has she's moving into the part of her career where her star is going to rise really high. And so I think that when you reach that point in your career, you start looking for ways to make your name national. And going to war over a cabinet appointment in this way, picking a fight is one way to sort of elevate your brand into national headlines, especially when you throw out something explosive as, this person is a foreign asset of, whichever power, right?
This is homeland all of a sudden.
But as an editor, though, Jude, as an editor, if a re one of your reporters came to you with the story, "Hey, Tulsi Gabbard is a foreign agent, according to,
Jeff Garland.
yeah, no, according, yeah, or whatever,
Doesn't
pick
matter.
it, some Illinois politician," what would you be demanding of that reporter?
Well, I'd make sure that well, if we were reporting on a politician saying it, I would make sure that the headline is "Politician says," quote, so that it doesn't look like we're just presenting it as fact.
And you'd think that would go without saying, Jude, but we all know it doesn't.
Yeah, it's true. There's a little bit of self-dealing out there in the liberal media environment. I know this comes as a surprise,
What?
but yeah, I think that I personally don't really buy any of these accusations. I don't think that there's any evidence that's going to come out that will surprise me on this front. So I think that between that and the relative consolidation of the Senate conference behind Trump, I think that Tulsi has a pretty good chance of getting through. I would be more worried for, well, I thought that Gates had a very tough row to hoe. But that's a non-issue now. I think that
Yes,
RFK Jr.
thankfully.
poss yeah, I
Thank
think that RFK Jr. possibly has a tougher row to hoe.
Sure.
But
That'll be a
Tulsi,
that'll be public.
yeah.
It's the Republican senator I was looking for, Todd Young.
Oh,
Todd
yes.
Young from Indiana, who is refusing to back Hegseth and invites a primary challenge, which, is the Republican Party's right. And I would respect them because the days of combined governance where you have a uniparty with squishy legislators is not something that the American people want anymore, I think. Anyway, I'd like to move on, if we could, to a question that involves the American Conservative and other publications. What is the future of the conservative journalism in the age of Trump?
Well, I think that as a big question, I think there are a few different things that are going on. Some of them that are pertinent to the Trump aspect of the Trump era, and some that are just, aspects of technological development that have changed the game. There's a, following his 2016 victory, there was a certain amount of self-sorting among the publications. You had publications that were more or less Trump sock puppets, were all Trump all the time, completely uncritical. You had publications that were supportive of his program, but maybe not wholly uncritical, supportive, but still keep your brain turned on, is how I like to think of it. And then you had publications that went down the Never Trump road.
Like the Bulwark and
Yes. My learned friends from the Weekly Standard all went off to various publications. Which is, just a side note. I disagreed with the Weekly Standard on a lot of things, but it was a well-done magazine. And I was sad to see it go under because there aren't that many well-done magazines anymore. So the I think that of those three, ideological or editorial groupings, it's the Trump propagandists who have had the most difficult time and who will have the most difficult time. The Never Trumpers have shown that there's pretty much an bottomless market for anti-Trump content from putative conservatives. Most of their subscribers are upper middle class Democrats from Connecticut, maybe, but the check's clear. So it's a living. So I think that they're never going to go anywhere. I think that the difficult part is those guys in the middle who may support aspects or even the majority of Trump's program, but have to have a brain about it. Have to say, well, maybe this thing actually isn't that great, or maybe we should push in that direction instead of this direction. And part of that is that the Trump relation to the media is different from prior Republicans, and certainly different from the way Democrats relate to their friendly media. If you criticize, at least per the evidence of the first term, and I see no reason to think this will change, if you criticize the administration's policies, people will stop talking to you. And it's a free country. There's no obligation for the administration to speak to any given journalist. But it does make it difficult to do reporting when you don't have any sources. So walking the line of supporting Trump, or supporting his policies, with your editorial line, but also not just being a pro-Trump robot, is a
Sure.
little bit difficult. Now, obviously, there are reasons that the Trump operation relates to the media that way. If I had undergone the last 8 years, from the inside of the Trump operation, I also would assume that I'm at war with any given journalist that I meet. And the feeling is largely that they don't need journalists because Trump speaks to the American people directly,
Sure.
through social media. So those are sort of as far as content goes, those are the challenges for conservative publications right now. And I think that how the next few years play out and what the success of the Trump program is, will largely influence how those guys in the pro-Trump but with a brain camp do. The other side of it is that a lot has changed technically in the past 8 years. 8 years ago, for example, the Weekly Standard still had a large print circulation.
Right.
Everybody except the Atlantic has reduced their print circulations, I think. The way that Twitter is handling publishing now, I think, has the possibility to change the game fairly radically. I can talk about that in a moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Substack revolution certainly changed the game a little bit. And I think that the sort of broad collapse of trust in media institutions, both left and right, which is in part due to social media. Social media, I think, I'm not going to say that it's a perfectly honest technology, but when the newspaper says one thing and then you see a video showing the opposite thing, it becomes much harder to lie for the
Right.
newspaper. So I think that every formal publication has suffered from that a little bit, rightly or wrongly. I think that people are just much more suspicious of organized publications than they were 8 or 10 years ago. So I think that organized, so there are you can either, you know, split off as an individual writer or reporter and try to do your own thing.
That works.
It does. If you're good, it works.
Right.
But the it turns out not everybody has the knack for writing and then also functionally running their own publication and editing their own publication. So I think that, you know, when you look at Substack, there's a fairly steep power law distribution. You know, the top 10 Substacks are enormously profitable.
Right.
And then it drops precipitously, and it's a very long tail.
Much like podcasts.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's I think, exactly analogous to podcasts. You know, now something that's curious is that podcasts are sort of analogous to radio. And radio, I think because of the nature of the technology, has still maintained highly consolidated, large markets. The syndicates still touch 30 million people in an afternoon, which is extraordinary and extremely humbling, I have to say, for somebody who works in the print press. the fact that, you know, Buck Sexton gets on the radio at 2 o'clock and in the first 15 minutes touches more people than have read everything I have ever written or edited combined.
People don't appreciate that. They give everyone always, in my whole career in radio, has always said, "Oh, radio's dying. No one listens to radio anymore." Like, well, no. I mean, that's not true. I don't think people think about it.
I mean, it really is. You know, I had a friend who was a producer over at Salem, and it was just astonishing. Still a huge reach, still a very engaged audience. I mean, that's the other thing. You know, people can subscribe to your publication, but are they writing you letters to the editor? Are they commenting on your website? You know, having an engaged audience is a guarantee that you have a future. So I think, you know, radio is still kind of underrated, which is funny since liberals spent the whole 1990s and 2000s freaking out about right-wing talk radio.
Yes, they did. I took a lot of those phone calls, Jude.
That must have been something. That must have been wild.
Yes. Yes, it was.
So I think that you know, for the future of conservative media, you're going to see some people going independent. I think that you're going to see a lot of projects that are sort of a synthesis of the two approaches, like the free press, which, once again, I don't really agree with their politics, but they're an impressive operation. Jonah Goldberg's The Dispatch, once again, don't really agree with politics, but they're an impressive operation. These are guys who have figured out how to sort of marry the old newsroom model. They still have editors. You know, editing, it turns out, is actually valuable. It's hard to put a dollar number on it, but it you know, people notice when things are edited or not edited. And they've been able to. Yeah, well, I mean, that was
charge money, you know.
Yeah, and it turns out, I mean, that's sort of the trick of it. You know, editors, especially copy editors, are always the first thing to go when a publication starts losing money. It's a while ago now, but about 10 or 12 years ago, the New York Times laid off 300 copy editors because they just couldn't support it anymore. That saved a lot of money. But people did definitely notice that quality declined. And it's hard to quantify. You know, it's hard to say, you know, it's like when you're moving, it's like when you're swimming in the ocean. Once you get below a certain depth, the water suddenly drops. The temperature of the water suddenly drops 10 degrees.
Sure.
And like there's a line that you pass with quality where people suddenly start saying, this is no longer a good publication.
And it's even broader than that. I mean, we've always talked about John and I. It was always good editors make, you know, are able to see, well, what's the other side? You know, even beyond copy editors, but it grows from there because now they're more stressed because they're covering this, trying to do that. And it's this trickle down effect where then there's no standard anymore and you wind up, you know, freewheeling it in the wild west that the internet.
We used to have editors who would ask those questions.
Right. And then
increasingly, as it became more of a neo-Marxist enterprise, at least in Chicago, those questions were not asked as often or as strongly or stridently. And as a result, I think the product, both the Tribune and Sun-Times, failed dramatically because of it. They didn't have...
Steep fall off, yeah.
They didn't have people questioning assumptions like, do we really need another feature story on the Old Town School of Folk Music?
They've been on your mind a lot lately, John.
I just think of the precious attitude of left wingers, you know, like that. We all should love the songs of the 60s sung by old hippies, you know, and like, and I'm just not into it.
The music of the white boy.
I'd rather listen to country music and drink beer, you know, but that's me.
Amen.
So the future of the news business, what is it? I guess.
You mentioned Twitter. Johnny, do you mind if we go back to that? I'd love to.
Yeah, okay, because I want to see. Yeah, I want to know how
circle back to it, because Twitter is, you know, even that universe, but even broader, any of these social medias. But Twitter specifically, you mentioned, is trying to change the game.
Yeah. So previously, so the new management over at Twitter has changed the model for what Twitter is, really. Twitter used to be basically a clearinghouse for journalists. You would link your story up there. And if you were a journalist, or especially if you were an editor, it was very useful to see, you know, what everybody was publishing. Right. You could click, you know, there was no sort of link suppression, which is something people complain about a lot now. You would see it as it came up. It was sort of like a bulletin board or a forum. There was a lot of other, you know, sort of noise there, but that was the basic utility. Now, Mr. Musk has decided that Twitter should make money. I can't blame him since he owns it. And so what they've done is they've made it, they have encouraged people to stay in the app or to stay on the web page, by, on the one hand, providing the infrastructure so that you can put longer form stuff on there, whether in video or in writing.
That's significant.
And so that you can paywall it. If you are, you know, a Twitter premium user, you can throw a paywall on one of your posts and say, this post is for subscribers. If you want to read it, you know, give me a nickel or whatever. And then you can read it. Obviously, Tucker has been pioneering the long form podcast on Twitter.
As have Victor Davis Hanson, who writes what amounts to like an 800 word essay now instead of 140 character.
How far we've come,
right?
Yeah.
And since you have the capacity to, so on the one hand you have this infrastructure, so you can actually put, you know, serious content on Twitter and make people pay for it. On the other hand, they have made Twitter less friendly to leaving the website. So the algorithm punishes posts that have external links in them, for example. Those no longer get promoted equally in the For You tab, which once upon a time, you know, Twitter has never been an enormous source of traffic relative to Facebook. But it did used to promote more traffic than it does now. So the sort of idea is that it becomes the everything app. You know, you can talk to your friends in it. You can read articles in it, similar to the way you can in Apple News, for example. So I think that, it's a matter of time before publications start. Well, I can see it happening in one of two ways. Legacy publications like mine start publishing their pieces in parallel on Twitter and have a separate paywall system on Twitter, or a separate subscriber system on Twitter. Or somebody tries to do what the Free Press did with Substack, and tries to build out an entire media company whose all of whose content lives within the Twitter ecosystem. And I think that's interesting. I think that that makes the there are just basic aspects of the news industry, basic assumptions we have about the way advertising works, for example, that change when you have everything living in this same little ecosystem
Right.
within the Twitter website or the Twitter app.
Do you think anything happened? I mean, I was seeing it as kind of, you've seen it with cable TV, for example, right? There was this kind of breakup. Everyone was clamoring to make have it their way or whatever. And then the ads kind of went through it and kind of followed that kind of model as things kind of separated. And we had all these one-off apps. And now we're kind of seeing we're kind of almost the reverse where it's snatching up this app and this company and that company. Do you see like the New York Times, taking a partnership now with I don't know, the Jonah Goldberg type, where it's like now we're recombining some of our more popular, the cream has risen to the top, and it's kind of a rebuilding of the way things were now, but just in the digital world.
I think you're already starting to see some of that. I think that the New York Times buying The Athletic
Right.
is a harbinger
Sure,
of
sure,
things to
sure.
come. I just speaking, anecdotally from my own experience as an editor, I have a number of writers who have written, contributed for me on a regular basis who have said to me, I tried to do the Substack Pro thing, and it's a lot of grinding.
Sure.
And unless you really get a big audience, you're not actually making that much money. We have, however, through history, developed this great technology for bringing writers together so that everybody doesn't have to write a great piece every day. And then somebody sits on top of them and, makes sure the stuff they put out is halfway decent. It's called a publication. So I think that, and the fact that they are coming to me and writing for me for commissions rather than putting their stuff on their Substacks,
Right.
I think indicates that there will be a bit of a bounce back towards consolidation. I think that one question, that, always comes to me. So I'm from Maryland,
Sure.
and we have, the Washington Post in DC, which does do some local reporting. They have a pretty decent metro section as these things go. And then there's the Baltimore Sun. And there's the Annapolis Gazette. And I think that there's one Annapolis Capital Gazette. And then there's a paper out in Western Maryland whose name I can't remember. But all of these local publications have sort of become shadows of their former selves. My question is whether one question that I am interested in and curious to see how it plays out is whether the reconsolidation leads to a rebirth of local news. Because I do think that that is something that is really lacking right now, that is being supplied by individuals who have a blog or who have a Substack about what's happening in Carroll County, Maryland. I think that would be a good thing.
Do you want to go local?
I think
Do you
so.
think going local is the thing? Well, you have to offer something that the others don't, that people can't get. Like you got to
Perspective.
whatever take you're known for, you have to.
It's all about perspective. It's like what you know. And speaking of perspective, Drew, before we wrap, I'd love to ask you. You're not from Chicago. You don't have any connections that I know of to Chicago aside from going to school in Michigan, right?
I went to school in Massachusetts.
Oh, my apologies.
No worries. I have friends in Michigan.
All right, well.
But to get to your question.
Chicago.
Yeah, tell us, give us the outsider's look.
Chicago, you know, as an inveterate East Coaster, seems like the New York of the Midwest, which, you know, may be unkind, but it's the other big, you know, immigrant heavy, somewhat industrial, somewhat financial city. You know, I think that my impressions of it are very similar to a lot of, you know, non-Chicagoans. You know, think of Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I think of the 1990s Chicago Bulls. You know, when I was, you know, a little kid, I said, oh, you know, Michael Jordan is the coolest man in the world right now, which simply was true. And so I really wanted to be a Chicago Bulls fan. And my father said, no, no, you have to be a Wizards fan because, you know, we live in the suburbs of D.C.
Oh, my condolences.
And that pretty much put the kibosh on my caring about professional basketball for the rest of my life. because being a Bulls fan, very cool, especially at that time, a lot of fun. Being a Wizards fan, never fun and certainly never cool. So, yeah, I think Chicago is, since it's not an international port the same way as New York, I think that in some ways it presents as more authentically American than New York. People talk about New York as being the greatest European city in America. and I think that there's some truth to that. You know, when you go to New York, especially if you're in lower Manhattan or in the older parts of Brooklyn, it does, you know, have a European feel to it. Whereas Chicago is America. It's, you know, Metropolis from Superman. So I guess the other association I have with it is the one time I have actually been to Chicago, it was enormously cold. I was connecting through O'Hare, and I was flying from New Orleans, so I had no winter clothes. And
it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and you decided to get a tuna fish sandwich, and there was Juicy Smollett.
That's right. And, you know, I was wearing my red hat, and the rest is history, right?
Dun, dun, dun. Yeah.
But yeah, I remember it being, you know, I went to school in Boston, which is not a warm city in January. And I remember thinking Chicago is something else entirely.
Yeah, that's us, hearty stock.
Yeah, well, we don't have a Boston. What's that fish house in Boston? The fish house? Boston Fish House? What is it? You get the oysters and so forth.
Oh, yeah, down by Seaport. You've got, there are a couple places you can go. There's Faneuil Hall up by, which is right by City Hall. There's,
it's the oldest,
a long time.
It's the oldest, one of the oldest restaurants in the country.
Well, Boston used to be able to claim a couple of those.
The Union Oyster House, is that what we're talking about, thinking of? Is that a place? I don't know. I'm using Google here.
where does Jude Russo take writers to have a discussion?
Yeah, there you go. That's the better question. Your home base.
In Boston or in Maryland?
Where do you
in
go?
Maryland. Where are you Maryland yeah.
Washington? Where?
In Washington, I go to the Bottom Line Bar, which has two things to recommend it. First is that it's less expensive than everything else in the neighborhood. And the second thing to recommend it is that it's 2 blocks from my office. if it's somebody I want to impress, the Salt Line down in Navy Yard is really good. I'm an oyster fiend. I'm a true child of Maryland. And they always have a very good raw bar.
East Coast or West Coast oysters?
East Coast.
They're so large. They're so big. That's what I like about them. Delaware oysters, even though I get a little nauseous thinking of Joe Biden there. You know, but outside of that, any association there. There's
Yeah,
nothing
well,
like it.
so Maryland, the bay was over oystered for decades and decades, and so they had to reseed a lot of the oyster beds and tell people leave these alone for years, and you can finally get Chesapeake oysters again. But a lot of them are those huge, originally Japanese Kumamotos, which some people don't like. Because they're not a super sophisticated flavor. They're sweet and fatty, but I like them. I think they're great. You throw some vinegar on there and you're set.
Vinegar, you have to have it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you got. We'll let's hit up the when you come in Chicago. Let's hit the Shaw's. Now that we know that you like oysters, we'll go.
I will take you up on that.
Right,
I
buddy.
will never say no to an oyster. Which will probably, some nut's going to hear me say that on this podcast, and it'll be my downfall. They'll, put a box propped with a stick and tray of oysters under it, and that's how they'll get me.
Yeah, they'll get you some way. Anyway. Yep.
Yeah. Jude, it's been great. Thanks for jumping on here. Where if people want to find you, where do you usually point them to? What's your favorite place?
For as far as
They want to find
you...
more. They want to find out more about you. They want to follow what you do. That
Oh
kind of
yeah, of
thing.
course. The American Conservative
Sure.
dot com is my publication's website. You can find my author page there. If you want to get in my inbox and yell at me, my email address is there.
Cool.
So that's sort of the one-stop shop as far as dealing with Jude Russo goes.
And is that beard on your X slash Twitter profile, is that a current representation of your face, or what are we looking at?
So over the summer, I shaved it off.
No.
So we just we had a new baby. And
Congratulations.
thank you, thank you. One of several. And she
Sure.
developed this habit
As one does.
of grabbing my beard and putting her entire weight on it and leaning out. And after a couple months of this, I said, I don't actually need to put up with this. I could just lose the beard. And for a while, she tried to grab the bottom of my chin and do the same thing, but she couldn't get the same kind of grip on it. So eventually, she stopped pulling on my face. But yes, I am clean shaven again. People say I look much younger, but it's something that I will have to put up with because I don't really like people pulling on my beard.
Yeah, I would not. I do not. I mean, except for your daughter, I would not accept it otherwise,
That's right.
Your daughter can do anything, but
And
like
they do. They do. They do.
stray freelance reporters cannot grab the editor's beard. I
That's true.
just
That'll get you on burn list.
right. Or Jude, by the way, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, Jude.
Thank you for having me on. It's been a real pleasure. Always glad to talk to folks.
And, please come back because I want to talk about the old days at the American Conservative when it was sort of like a subversive one to me. I mean, I'm so old now. To me, it was like a subversive magazine because everything out there was so, conventionally left-wing, liberal, and it wasn't. And so having the American Conservative on your desk in a pile was like a declaration is like a flag for reporters. Like I'm not easily tribal.
Well, and I hope
So
that we keep it that way.
thank you.
I mean, it is, we there were two magazines in America that said the invasion of Iraq is a bad idea. Harper's, and then the American Conservative. So we're used to being a little bit contrary to even our fellow travelers. And that's something that we really do try to stick to. The motto is principles over party, ideas over ideology. And I hope that we live up to that. Especially, the three gentlemen who founded us, Scott McConnell, Pat Buchanan, and Taki Theodorakopoulos, were all clearly guys who valued ideas over ideology and principles over party. So it's always glad I'm always glad to hear that people still think of us that way. I hope that
Oh,
they
yeah.
always will.
For Jude Russo, editor of the American Conservative, one of the finest publications in the country, and you will find it listed on my website, John Cass News, on the to the on the right rail under what I'm reading, because it's so good. I want you all to try it. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer, WGN Radio, my friend, co-host here, and future physics teacher, the baker of pies, the friend of cats. And for me, John Cass, editor of John Cass News, where you always get a good cup of Midwestern common sense. Thanks for joining us on the Chicago Way podcast, and talk to you again next time. Thank you.